To begin with, thank you so much, Scarlett, for the invitation and receiving us in this heavenly place. Very nice trailer of what's waiting for us in the beyond. So we have to begin as soon as possible to get a glimpse of that. So this is a very interesting trailer, especially in the company of all of you, which also is part of, at least in our conception, is what is waiting for us there. I mean, we won't see ourselves like isolated in transcendence, but accompanied by like-minded people that will join us in our eternal life, eternal journey. So today, the invitation was made for having this very beautiful interfaith meeting, which is not the very first one I'm part of, and I'm really very fond of taking part in this type of exchanges. At least to begin with, it's very much, it may sound selfish, but it's quite nourishing for my own journey. But of course, my own journey is not about selfishness, so that's not selfish at the end of the day. So I thank you so much, all of you, for giving me the opportunity of sharing with you to begin with, and whatever I can share in the service of the divine and your service, that will be my greatest fortune. So as Scarlett was mentioning, and I was thinking along those lines, she was saying, well, here at least we have two traditions being present here and exchanging ideas. And I was thinking, interestingly, and sometimes our tradition is generally described as Hinduism, but at the same time I was thinking, technically speaking, in our own tradition, if we want to speak about Hinduism, there are so many interfaith connections inside Hinduism. So that's an interesting thing to begin with. What to speak of Christianity and Islam and Buddhism and so on, but just to begin at home, if you will, there are so many layers and directions. And sometimes people ask us, what's Hinduism? And or they ask me, do you practice Hinduism? And I first ask them, what do you understand by Hinduism? Because I may say yes, and you got the wrong idea. And I may say no, you got the wrong idea. So Hinduism is a complex array of possibilities, if you will, where basically the idea is to address the specific situation in which every soul, every person is in life. So it may seem that it is pointing to multiple directions, but actually the situation is people is in multiple different situations. But ultimately, the ultimate converging point is not multiple, basically. No? Because sometimes, and I know that Scarlett acknowledged that she did some research maybe in Google or something sharing some quick idea, and I appreciate her enthusiasm, but she invited me to clarify some details that we may not consider that accurate there. Mm-hmm. And one of them may be the notion that sometimes Hinduism is about polytheism, for example, no? Like multiple gods. Yeah. So actually, technically speaking, we are not considering that view, but actually Hinduism may speak about many gods, but actually when they use the word gods, it's gods not with capital G, if you will. when we speak about God with capital G, we are speaking about one single supreme person, because for God to be God, it has to be one. If you have two, no longer you have the one without the second, as sometimes it is called. So when Hinduism speaks about gods with small g, it has to do more with certain personalities that are considered in our tradition like administrative figures of different aspects of nature. Like sometimes you may hear, oh, the god of the sun, the god of the moon, the god of heaven. It has more to do with, per person. In Hinduism, there is a lot of emphasis in personalism. Everything is personalized. So you have the sun planet, but we can see there is someone behind the planet, the ball of fire, no? Administrating it, so every single day it's coming on time and retiring on time. There is some consciousness, some intelligence behind that. And sometimes these personalities are called gods. But actually, again, small g. When we get to the idea of capital G, we are speaking about one person. But that's not the end for us. It gets a little bit more nuanced, because for us, that single supreme person, being the supreme person, it also has unlimited how to say, features or limited faces. As we ourselves, who are not unlimited, we have different faces in the sense of, I don't know, we are here now and we show a particular face of our personality. But if my, I don't know, if my mother comes now, I show a different face. If my grandmother comes, I'm a grandson. Mm-hmm. And if my wife, I don't have a wife, I'm a Swami. If my wife will come, if I will not be a Swami, I was shown a different face. I'm still the same person, but there are different emotional moments in my life. Do you follow my point? Mm-hmm. So in that same line, we think in terms of the divine. God has different emotional moments, transcendental emotional moments. Again, it's just an analogy. I don't want to fully make a full comparison, but sometimes in order to speak about transcendence or that which lies beyond words and beyond thought, sometimes we need to take some point of reference from where we are now, but having very clear that this goes way beyond that. So, according to our particular tradition, yes, God is unlimited, so he manifests himself in unlimited forms. Especially in our tradition, which, as Dave says, is called bhakti. Bhakti has to do with love, with devotion. So for us, the goal is to develop love for God and establish an eternal loving relationship with the divine. So we are monotheistic, but sometimes we could qualify that further by saying our practice sometimes called polymorphic monotheism, which means one God, but multiple forms of that one God. Because we consider, okay, God is unlimited, so he can have many forms in his unlimitedness while still remaining one. One and many. We have to go beyond this logic to reach that point, basically. No? You have a question, sir?
I just wanted to ask, in your description of the little g gods, mm-hmm. from what you just said, it sounds like you're saying these are different aspects of mm-hmm. the one God, mm-hmm. As opposed to, say, minor entities themselves, mm-hmm. they're not like angels or something, mm-hmm. they're all mm-hmm. entities or aspects of the one God.
Yeah,
what you're saying.
Yeah, okay. We are mm-hmm. on the same page, yeah, clearly. And in speaking about these different faces of the divine, for example, one of the three main categories that sometimes are mentioned, there are so many descriptions about, because again, how can you speak about unlimited faces of the divine? It's unlimited. There's no only one way of speaking about that. But one way of that they are described is in the terms of three Sanskrit terms called Brahman, Paramatma, and Bhagavan. I'm making just a brief introduction here, but my main interest is if you may have any ideas or thoughts or questions, and I will maybe willing to have dialogue, but I'm giving just a brief introduction. So these ideas of Brahman, Paramatma, and Bhagavan mostly have to do with, Brahman has to do with an undeterminate, if you may like to call, aspect of the divine, or sometimes an aspect which is more connected to the idea of effulgence, and light, and energy, but without specification about personality. It's like not so much emphasize this idea of God is a person that you can relate to. I mean, that's there. But in one aspect of the divine, sometimes it's called the effulgence of the divine. Sometimes the analogy is given. You have the sun, you have the planet sun, or what we may say, the God of the sun, as I was speaking before with small g, the God of the sun, the planet sun itself, and the rays of the sun. So all of them are the sun. Sometimes the rays of the sun are entering, and we will say, oh, the sun enters. But at the same time, the sun did not enter, because if not, the meeting is over, and all of us as well. So it entered and it did not... Yeah, one idea. It entered and it did not enter at the same time. So again, it sounds contradictory, but it makes sense at the same time. There's some type of logic beyond normal logic. Sorry, yeah. No problem.
What is your idea? How do you describe personhood?
Mm-hmm.
When you say, you use the word person.
Mm-hmm.
How do you mean it? I'm a little confused how is God, as you describe it, a personal God? Mm-hmm. And if that's true, and there are so many aspects of the way to express that, that unexpressible,
mm-hmm.
how do you relate to the personhood of God if there are so many ways in which to relate to it?
Okay, yeah, thanks for the question. One line of Vedanta, one of our main texts, say Ikshate Na Shabdat, which means some tend to interpret that line that you can say anything about God because whatever you may say is never enough. But we will understand that line as you can never say enough about Him. But nonetheless, we will try our best because we have this something called tongue and speech capacity. So we have to fulfill that organ in its in an attempt of saying something about that. But having in mind, I will never be able to fully say all that it is about. No? So God can, it has an impersonal aspect and it has a personal aspect. For us, that's part of Him being unlimited and absolute. He can be also, because if we say He cannot be impersonal, we are limited. We are limiting the unlimited, basically. No, but in our particular tradition, we are most interested in the personhood of the divine, because that's what allows us to establish an, a relationship, basically. We can relate in a loving interaction with, if you will, a mass of light. We can experience something with that. There can be peace and some other experiences that have been described in our tradition. But our main interest in our bhakti school, which bhakti again means devotion, is basically loving God. And God is a person, of course. When we say person, we maybe immediately think about us as a person. And at the, there is a connection with us as a person, but at the same time, it's important to bear in mind He's something else, because if not, what's the difference between Him and us? No? And for us, it's a very important point, and I think that for Christians as well, maybe from different sides, but the aspect of the humanity, humanness, and divinity. No, for us as well, it's a very crucial, two crucial ingredients to keep in mind. I mean, we are not just after divinity without humanity. No. And for us, one of the best ways to divinize, if you will, humanity is to keep the divine connected to the human side, in one sense. I mean, my point is, if God becomes is transcendent, in one sense, to humanity, I mean, we sometimes relate humanity to frailty and vulnerability and imperfection. But when I'm saying God is human, I'm not saying He's prone to limitation and imperfection. He's perfect, but at the same time, in our tradition, again, we worship mainly this aspect of this form of God, or face of God, if you will, called Krishna. And Krishna is God appearing to us in human-like form. The word human is important, but the word like is equally important. It's human form, but human-like. No? So there are some details that make Him remain be God at the same time. No? So there are many different forms of God, and the different forms of God, according to our tradition, are, if you will, the result of a particular type of approach that each devotee, each worshiper, has towards God. In other words, if I approach God and would like to establish a relationship with Him in a more, if you will, majestic, reverential mood, there is a particular form, if you will, or face of God corresponding to that type of love. If I would like to worship God mostly in a connection of intimacy or conceiving Him in different relationships, even in Christianity you can find different hints about these ideas of considering God as master and I am the servant, or considering God as a friend, or more in connection with Jesus, or even hints in some traditions about one serving God in a Jesus being more worshipped as a child, and the devotee developing more like paternal feelings. Or you have the Song of Songs, where you find hints of romantic love in connection to divinity. So for us, in our tradition, there's a lot of all these things as well. Like God being who He is, He offers us all these different possibilities which constitute the emotional like centers of our own human experience, because try to imagine you as humans, you take out of your life your friends, your romantic relationships, and your parents. What remains of you? I mean, who are you without that? So for us, all those things that are so crucial for us here on Earth are so crucial here because somehow they represent a reflection of what is so crucial there and has God as the center. And for us, the perfection of all these different loving relationships, all these shades of love, find their perfect center and expression in connection to the divine. So in our tradition, we conceive that some practitioners may have affinity to serve God. Again, in servitude per se, God is my master, I am his servant. Some others will feel inspiration to serve him as friends. And there's a whole liturgy and narrative description in our scriptures about how you can relate with God as a friend, or as him being a fatherly figure, or you taking the fatherly role and seeing Krishna in terms of being like your darling, if you will, and so on. I'm just being very brief. I mean, there's so much to say. I'm having trouble in trying to summarize all these things. I'm trying to make it somehow user-friendly for you to digest in our first meeting, but something like that. No. So there, one more point, sorry. So according to, there's one verse in the Gita, where Krishna, Bhagavad Gita, Krishna is saying, So he basically says, according to how someone approaches me, God is speaking here. So according to how someone approaches me, I reciprocate accordingly. I show myself in a particular way according to the type of love that that person is coming with. Because there are nuances of love. It's not just only one way. Because if we start to limit that those possibilities, unconsciously we may be limiting, again, the unlimited. So we try to bear that in mind. And if I can mention one more thing, I know you may want to share something. The concept Krishna that we especially are inclined to, it's a very particular idea of God, because, as I like to say, sometimes we speak in terms of God beyond God. In which sense? God, in one sense, sometimes is seen as like universal cosmic administrator, the creator of the world, or how to say, maybe more seen in connection to this world and us. In our tradition, we conceive that aspect is there, but also we conceive the aspect of God in his own, if you will, private life. And he himself wanted us to be part of that, for sure. But he has having his own God at home, as we may like to call it. No? Sometimes I give the analogy of the president of a country. No? So the president may go. Maybe it's not the most becoming analogy to compare God with the president, but whatever. I don't want to enter into political sensibility. Every country is different. But generally in every country, I said the president and everyone like, it's not the most beloved figure, but whatever. Let's imagine about the very beloved president in some country. So... So he, when he's going or she's going to the presidential house every day to work, if you will, the president here is entering the White House, he's the president there, and everyone relates accordingly. No? We always give the example. Everyone greets the person in a certain way. There's some reverence there. You can just jump on the president and how are you doing, my friend? And you may lose your head even. No? So there's a certain bureaucracy and ways of dealing there. So he's not at home there. Most of us may know the president as the president, but actually the president has his own personality, if you will, his own inner life, his own intimacy. And that happens when he leaves the White House and enters his home properly. And maybe his grandson is waiting for him. And the grandson is not thinking the president of the United States is entering the house. be thinking, Grandpa is coming, and he will jump on his head and tell, go to the floor and walk like a snake or whatever. And you have the President of the United States like crawling like this on the ground. Someone very powerful that make one country disappear by pressing one button, now is crawling on the ground by a higher power, the power of affection. You follow? So he's still the president, but he has totally forgotten about that there. He's not aware of that at that moment. His grandson is not aware of at that moment. All his family members are not seeing him in those terms. He's aware, my husband, my father. You follow my point? So somehow we apply this criteria to God also. You have the God who is God in the presidential house, the cosmic administrator, the ruler of the world, and so on. And that aspect is there. But also we have God when he goes home, if you will, in the intimacy of home, where the love he's receiving is such that he forgets his God. He's still God. I mean, it's not that he stopped being God. But the power of the affection that is coming to him, the purity of the love that is surrounding him, is so overwhelming to him, in a charming way, I'm not saying, in a positive overwhelming, that he forgets that he's God and he behaves in another way. Like the president crawling on the ground, if you will. He behaves in ways that he doesn't seem to be God. He seems like an ordinary person. But actually, if you analyze the context, you realize this is not ordinary, this is super extraordinary. This is more extraordinary than when he's in the presidential house. Do you follow my point? So for us, that's the notion of Krishna. When you study the life of Krishna or Krishna, it doesn't seem he's God. He seems, in one sense, closer to us in certain things. But when you pay close attention to that, you realize, oh, he's God and more, if you will. So that's my point. When I say God, I mean he at the presidential house, the president, God. But at home, nobody's treating him like God. They're treating him with further intimacy. So that's the approach we take to the divine. But of course, in our particular school, but we acknowledge there are so many other ways to approach him, and all of them are valid. I mean, in that realm, there's not like better or worse, or this is the best. No, there's one nice verse in our tradition that one of our teachers, he says, every devotee, every lover of God will feel, my connection with God is the best. Not in an egoic sense, but in a, oh, this is the best for me. Mm-hmm. And he says, and every one of them is correct. So that's a pretty much interfaith conclusion, if you will. I will continue speaking, so you say something.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I'm getting the sense that in your tradition, Krishna is very much like the Christ figure in the Christian sense, in that the familiarity that we seem to have with God, but we also know that God is really not that familiar. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's the God who is the God of the cosmos, as well as the God of the earth, you know. And when you describe Krishna. Is Krishna...
By the way, very similar to Christ, the word. If you analyze the etymology, okay. There's another lecture, but there's quite close.
Am I getting this right? Because I think a tremendous similarity between what you're describing in Krishna and how he fulfills his position in our belief system and Christ. Mm-hmm. I know there are differences.
Yeah.
I find it remarkable. Yeah.
There are differences as well as there are, of course, common points. And for us, the two of them are equally important.
Yeah.
I mean, to get to the commonalities and find that common ground, but also to appreciate the variety, which is, as they say, the spice of life. Of course, if you put too much spice on the food, it's not so nice. So, so we like variety, but unity has to be like underlying to make sense of the variety, because if not too much variety, it's just conflict and problems and anxiety, and too much unity is boring. No, if we agree on everything, always, it's like, my God, I would like to differ a little bit from you. Why? So And for us, even that variety, when it is expressed in terms of in religious terms, it's not only something in our tradition. We do not only think, okay, you are Christian, so you feel your faith is the best. Okay, it's okay for you. No, it's not only, it doesn't end there, but it's, please tell me about your faith so I can be inspired in my own faith by hearing about your testimony of faith. That's the ideal platform of interreligious dialogue. It's not only, I allow you to speak and then comes my turn and you hear me, but I'm willing to be nourished by what is nourishing you, and hopefully vice versa. There's a nice example in one of our main books. I would like to share that in this connection. I always like to share that, which is a very nice example. I wouldn't call it interreligious, but I will call, as Thomas Merton calls it, I like Thomas Merton a lot, intra-religious. No? Because he says, in order to have interreligious dialogue, first we have to have dialogue inside of ourselves, with ourselves, intra-religious. Because if I'm exposing myself to someone of another faith, and I put quote-unquote another, because I don't like to point it like opposites or something, in order to be successful in that interaction, I have, first of all, to have very clear where I am and how I'm properly situated in my faith, so I can be nourished in my own faith from hearing other faiths, and I don't feel the need to defeat others or prove myself as higher or all these type of things that will be happening in the neophyte stages of every faith, to be realistic. You know, there are stages in the development of our faith, and in the beginning we call that Kanishta, which means a faith that doesn't include the bigger picture yet. It's more about what I'm doing, my God, if you will, my process, and this is the best, but I don't have the capacity yet to feel this is the best for me, but not necessarily for everyone else, and I feel the need to convert the whole world so they further confirm my weak faith, because I'm not able yet to have faith for myself, so I need the whole world converted in my creed. So, okay, I must be in the right place because everyone else is doing what I'm doing or something. But when you grow, as I heard also from Richard Rohr, another nice Christian monastic that I like a lot, he'll say, okay, we are on the same page, Scarlett. Richard Rohr, Franciscan monk. Okay. So he likes to speak a lot about elders. Elders and how every tradition needs an elder. And he said one of the features of the elder is that person is in a place, inner place, that person can actually convert people, but he doesn't feel the need to do so. He could do that. He has the charisma, or she, the power, the knowledge, the realization, the insight, but he doesn't feel the urge of, I have to convert all of you here to whatever. So that what makes that person an elder. He can do that, but he doesn't feel the need for that. So going back to this section of one of our scriptures regarding intra-religious dialogue, it's one book called Brihad Bhagavatamrita. In this book, it's a very nice book because it narrates, I will call, like, the ontological journey of a particular devotee who has some affinity to serve Krishna in a particular way, like a friend, but it is depicted as a journey, and he's kind of traveling through different planets, which actually represent different conceptions of the divine. So he's going through different conceptions, and he's reaching a particular place which corresponds with that conception, and he sees all these devotees worshipping God in this particular way, and he appreciates that always. It's not that, oh, this is not my take, I continue my journey. No, he's like, wow, so nice. But at the same time, he feels, but this is not my call. So he continues. He continues till he reaches his place, if you will. But in the context of doing so, he's been nourishing himself from everyone's devotion. So at one point, this main character of the story, if you will, called Gopakumar, he meets a famous devotee in the whole of India called Hanuman, which sometimes is depicted as a monkey personality who worships one face of the divine called Ram. So Gopakumar meets Hanuman. So here you have two great lovers of God, but who choose to love God or feel called to love God from different perspectives. One, Gopa Kumar loves God as a friend. And Hanuman loves God in servanthood. God is my master, I'm his servant. Both are loving God, but there is a different taste to that. So it's nice because Gopa Kumar meets Hanuman, and he's not saying, Hanuman, hey Hanuman, hear about how I love God and be inspired with that. No, he's saying, please sing about your Lord, no? Glorify your Lord, which is of course his Lord. They are speaking about the same person, but from different emotional perspectives. So please sing about your Lord. So Hanuman starts to glorify, to do kirtan as we were doing today, to sing different songs and praise of the Lord. And Gopa Kumar is hearing that. And when everything finishes, he says, my faith in Krishna, his own Lord, the same but with different name, has been so nourished by hearing about your devotion for your Lord. And then Hanuman says, now you sing about your Lord. Again, both of them know we are speaking about the same Lord, but they use this expression. So Gopa Kumar starts to sing about Krishna. And Hanuman hears and he ends, at the end he says, Jai Sri Ram. No? So he glorifies his own Lord. No? The conclusion is, by hearing about your love for your Lord, my own love is growing, and vice versa. So at the end of the meeting, both go back, no, overwhelmed, overflowing with love by meeting each other. No?
I want to say something really quick, because that's exactly what David and I have. Because we come on Tuesday and we're just like, where do you get a chance to actually share with someone how much you love God? We get to come together and we're talking about, we don't say, so how are you, David? It's how are you with God? You know, it's like, so we are so joyful and we're so excited. We get to spend that time. You know, you see God, I see God, but it's, you know, we know it's the same God. We're just so nourished from those Tuesdays. So David gets up in the morning and goes, Susie. He wants to come. I want to go. You know,
it's wind in my sails. Yeah, like, but I know it's Tuesday. Like, okay, I get to,
we get to
go
spend
and talk
time
to Scarlett
talking
about
God. We love God. You know, even in my tradition in Christianity, there's rare times that you connect with someone who really loves God so much that you can just come with them and say, let's talk about how much we love God. You know, I just want that so David can feed me to do that, you know?
And I'm fed
you are feeding him for sure.
Yeah.
And that's the idea. Now, there's a point in our practice that, as we were mentioning, in the beginning, still there may be duality and we may think more in tribal terms, no? Like your tribe, your group, my God. But eventually, as any practitioner advances in what I may call mysticism, which means going beyond this mind duality and started to enter in touch with the unified field, as sometimes it's called, like non-dual type of thinking, and realize ultimately we're speaking about the absolute, and the absolute there is no duality. Although there are expressions, the diversity of expression, but not dual expressions, that's a different thing. No? That God may have different faces doesn't mean that he's dual. No? But on the basis of that absolute unity, he's expressing so many sides of his heart, if you will. No? So that should be like the default pattern when mature practitioners meet from any tradition. Because again, we know that if you are not mature, no matter even if you are from the same tradition, you will be fighting with each other. Maybe you agree on the same tradition, but you disagree with so many things about the same tradition. So I don't know why you're laughing.
Well, it seems maybe it's really our ego that chooses which path it's going to be. I'm going to be Buddhist, or I'm going to be, you know, Christian, or I'm going to be whatever. whatever. You know, it's more of what matches our personality, perhaps, what we've been introduced to. Mm-hmm. But the path, it seems that we choose these religions, or we're exposed to certain religions, but the path is the same. Mm-hmm. I mean, not the path is different, but the source is the same.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, again, the source is the same, but as I mentioned, there's variety in that same source. So we like to think
we're attracted to that to the path.
Mm-hmm.
But we're attracted to like finding our people or mm-hmm. the expression that the people are using to get mm-hmm. to that source. Mm-hmm. But
yeah.
But we don't have to. It's like maybe it's judgment and power and politics that keep us, that draw us to certain paths.
I mean, it may be that, I agree, but I wouldn't say that necessarily in every single case. I will say, you ended up being a Christian because of politics or of ego. I mean, it can be. I mean, you can approach a spiritual tradition from an egoic perspective, even, and you can remain. Or maybe so many things can happen. You can approach a tradition with a really sincere heart, and eventually in the course of your practice, you can become entangled by different egoic situations, and you can continue practicing for the wrong reasons. To the point, as Thomas Merton will say, that you are running after purity and sanctity as a way to satisfy your ego. Because I want to be a saint. I want to be known as a saint, maybe, but not I want to be a saint. So all the things can happen in any tradition. It's not speaking about how nice or bad is the tradition in itself, but how sincere, how much integrity do we have as practitioners. No? So, and I would say that in many cases, because one may ask, and I speak a lot about that I don't want to sound like I'm promoting my book, but I am speaking a lot about that in the book. About like, what's the reason for us ending up in a particular tradition or in another one? Because in one sense, we could say that it's not necessarily some conscious choice. I mean, before myself joining the particular tradition I belong to, I mean, a few days before, it's not that I was like making plans. Okay, I will join this particular brand of Hinduism and end up being a Swami and so on. So, and it was not on my agenda, but it was on someone else's agenda, basically. No. So, in one sense, we could express that. No, I mean, God has such a variety of faces and aspects. Again, it's. I mean, we are speaking about God, but we have to bear in mind, we cannot get the full picture ever. It's so much, so overwhelming. We can just touch one point in one infinite line of this. So it's also very much important, at least in our side, to think, I mean, God is calling us in a particular way, in a particular path, or in another particular path. And it's not necessarily a matter of I'm being in this particular practice because of ego or politics. I mean, again, it can happen, but it's not necessarily the case in every case. In many cases, people is really willing to transcend ego and to transcend all those type of things, and they're getting closer to spirituality because of that. No, I mean, at least in my personal case, that was the case. I'm not saying I'm beyond ego, but my initial quest for looking for God and so on was like, I was really perceiving the problem of ego and the problem on some degree. When I started to practice, I started to become even more acquainted how much of a problem is ego, and how much ego do I have? Yeah. So that's part of practicing, no? You start practicing thinking, yeah, I'm impure and I have this and that. But when you start to really practice and clean your heart, you start to realize how much cleansing has to be done there. So it may be heavy, hard to deal with, but it's part of awakening to the job that is in front of us, no? So of the my guru, my spiritual preceptor, he sometimes describes this process as, or he describes the guru in itself, or like the principle of the spiritual teacher, he's like an interior decorator, no? That you invite the person, you pay to the person, the person first thing the person is doing is taking things and throwing them out of the window. This is not good. I say like, I'm paying you for doing this. I mean, I'm paying you for decorate the house. So yeah, we will reach that moment. But first we have to get rid of the stuff that doesn't need to be here. And after that comes the ornamentation and beautifying. But first you have to get rid of the dirt, if you want to. So that's a particular stage of practice. And again, I don't think it's only belong to our tradition. I mean, I'm speaking and all of you are... Yeah, so in that sense, we are on the same page. No, the words we choose, the way we approach that, there may be variety. Of course, there should be variety. But yeah, I would say that there is place for being called to one tradition or the other by God's invitation. No? Like also Thomas Merton says, no, regarding monasticism, no, I'm a monk. And again, it was not my plan to be a monk. Although, as I narrated in a recent interview I had, I was never attracted to having a family. So I was pretty much overwhelmed, like, what's going on with me? Because I was not inclined towards having partners, girlfriend, boyfriend. I remember my parents coming to me one day. I was like, I don't know, 17 years old. I'm only child. So it's an old darling. We wanted to tell you that no matter which decision you take in life, we will always love you. And I replied to them, I'm not gay. I mean, I don't have a problem with that, but that's not the situation. So what's going on, they ask me. And I say, I don't know, I'm trying to figure that out. And of course, when I met the portal of monasticism, I felt called in that direction. So Thomas Merton will say, God can only make monks. Now, if you try to make monks like by your own effort, let's produce more, you will ruin the order at the end. No. So it's some higher call that, again, it was not in your agenda, but it was in someone else's agenda. And we want to live for that agenda. My guru will say, we don't want to make God part of our agenda. We want to be part of God's agenda. No? It's a gradual process. Now, in the beginning, we may end trying to make God part of our agenda. And he's so generous, he accepts. He said, well, we have to begin somewhere. Krishna says that in the Gita, Chatur Vida Vajante Mam, and so on. He said, Gyan Jnasur Artati Gyani Chavara Tarshava. He's saying, some people approach me because they want money, because they are suffering a lot, they want to stop suffering, because they want knowledge, or others because actually they want me. But I accept all of them. No? And gradually the ones who approach me for more superficial reasons eventually will realize what's the real deal, if you will. At the end they will realize, I don't want knowledge from you, I don't want money from you, I want you. I want to serve you. And not only I want to serve you, but for us in our tradition, bhakti, for us bhakti is the process and for us bhakti is the goal. We want to love and serve God, so the goal is to love and serve God. We are not looking for something separate, basically. No. So that for us is a very important point in our tradition. We are not worshiping God or trying to love God so we can get something else higher than that, because there's nothing higher than that. No. Once someone asked one of our gurus, Srila Prabhupada, we are chanting this mantra, Hare Krishna, we were chanting in the beginning, which is a way of praising God. So someone asked him, what's the result of chanting Hare Krishna? And he said, the result is that you will be able to chant more Hare Krishna. Because we are not after anything else. You are glorifying God. What's the result? You will be able to glorify God in the more comprehensive way. It's not that I will obtain a new car, a greater house, I will stop suffering. I mean, I will increase my love for God. And there's no limit to that increasement. So that goal can always be attained a little bit more, if you will. It's not that you reach a point that, okay, I'm loving God enough, I kind of love Him more. I mean, if you say that, it means you don't understand what love means, and what means God, and what means love towards God. Because when we love in an imperfect direction, if we are loving a limited object, we may find some limitation in that love, but when you repose your loving propensity into the perfect object of love, that is God, there's no limit to how much you can love and how much He is willing to reciprocate. So that speaks for an eternal relationship that will have no end, that is constantly expanding and increasing. No? So for us, that's the idea. Even some of our teachers have said things like, because as you may know, and as the paper says, we consider the idea of reincarnation and different lifetimes. So in some sections of Hinduism, great emphasis is put of, let's stop this cycle of birth and death and reincarnation, sometimes called samsara. Let's get freed from this. Moksha, sometimes called mukti. But in our tradition, that's not so important, basically. Because for us, the goal of life is not to get to stop dying, if you will. But for us, the goal is to die to the ego and to awake to real life. And if that's happening, I don't care remaining here forever, basically. So you have many, many statements from different teachers. I won't torture you with more Sanskrit, that you had enough dose for today. But they will say things like, I don't care coming over and over again to this world as long as I can serve and love God. Send me wherever you want. Because if I can love you, wherever I will be, that's heaven, because I'm loving you. But if I will be in heaven, hypothetically speaking, not loving you, that's hell. Of course, that won't happen. You cannot enter there. But my point is, heaven or hell is more about, if you will, a state of consciousness. If you are internally in the proper place, you are already there. It's not so much about geographical movement. I will be carrying there, I will be carrying here, and so on. Anyhow, some ideas, but I would like, if you have some things you would like to share, or questions, or whatever.
Because you just talked about the reincarnation a little bit. My first question, I have a list.
Okay. That's a list of questions? Oh, that's the paper you shared.
But that is my paper.
That's your paper.
This is different. My paper.
Oh.
When you have been liberated.
She's the host. We have to honor the host. I'm ready for all the questions.
She gets to ask all the questions.
When you've been liberated, I might be saying it wrong, okay, but when you've been liberated from the cycles of reincarnation, what happens then?
What happens there?
Yes, when you're not going to come back, happens?
Well, again, it will depend on which type of prospect you are pursuing in your particular school.
Okay.
But let's speak in terms of monotheistic devotional traditions in Hinduism, let's say. So when you transcend the cycle of birth and death, which in one sense means transcending, it means you develop a certain type of consciousness and desires that do not longer correspond with what's going on in the realm of, let's say, selfish acquisition and exploitation. And when you are when you are free from all selfishness, let's put it in a negative, in via negativa, as they say. No, you are free from selfishness. It means there's a corresponding place to someone who is no longer selfish. And of course, it's not only about not being selfish, but being fully dedicated. No? So there are two sides of the equation. Not only being free from all selfishness, but being full of giving capacity. No? And feeling that the giving is the receiving. No? That's our school. Our school is not so much, if I give, I receive. No? Because some people, there are different degrees. No? Some people is not giving, just receiving. If I give, I lose. No, I have less, so I have to receive. They think in more mathematical terms, if you will. And other people will think the giving is the receiving. No? It's not mathematics, it's go beyond logic, because in numerical terms, if I give, I have less. But in a more subtle sense, I have more.
More blessings to
give. But on a higher level, you will think not even by give I receive, you will think giving is the receiving. So by giving, the only thing I will receive is the chance of giving more. I'm not giving something to expect receiving something different from what I'm giving, just to expand my capacity of giving that. So that's for us the idea of what's going on after liberation. Bhakti, our particular tradition, is more connected with what we may call a post-liberated status. We are, and in our scriptures, there's quite detailed definition of what's going on once you are liberated. No? I recently read also from Richard Rohr, he will say that. He said, we as Christians, he said, emphasize a lot redemption and being redeemed. But he said the real question is, what will happen after we are redeemed? What we will do with our redemption? No, we are redeemed, so let's see now. What you do now, that at that moment. So we are also a lot into that. Once we are beyond birth and death, once we are liberated, the real thing begins, in one sense. And for us, it's an eternal life of love with God. And there's very detailed, and I speak for my tradition here, very detailed account and description of how does it take place. Again, it's just a glimpse of something unlimited, but something has been said of how you live eternally in God's realm on a daily basis, interacting with Him and so many other like-minded servants, with pure love, with no selfish motives. And the only interest is, again, serving God. And of course, the only interest of God is serving those who are serving Him, because God is not a selfish guy who is there, okay, serve me, how nice, come, thank you. But the example given sometimes in our tradition is that of the stomach. Now, stomach is when you eat, as you will do or have been doing, or we continue doing after, the food goes in the mouth. There's a process. No, you don't eat through your ears or through your nose. Go through your mouth, and it converges into the stomach. And someone may protest. No, let's say all the organs of the body protest. Why everything is going into the stomach? No, so selfish. Stomach is taking everything. But what happens after? What's the stomach doing? You know better than me. It's distributing everything. It's not taking anything for himself at the end. It's giving energy to every single part of the body. So similarly, God is like the stomach. All it goes to him, or like the root of the plant, but he doesn't take anything for him. Actually, he transforms all that in service to his servants. So that's our idea. We are servants of God, but God is servant of his servants. Everyone there is a servant. That's an interesting idea. Everyone thinks of himself as a servant. God included. Because the idea with this is there is so much taste in serving that God himself chooses to be a servant. Above being God, as I mentioned. The God designation, he's still God, but there, in relation to his lovers, if you will, servants, he chooses to be a servant of them because he finds so much taste there. And I know that's a little strong in this world, because for most people the idea of being a servant is like, oh no, thank you. Yeah. Because generally the master is not very loving. So serving is like, oh no.
But one of the things in our tradition that has caused a problem, in my mind in certain ways, is the idea of slavery. We have Paul who talks about being a slave to Christ.
We also use that term.
Yeah, and it's a hard one. Especially in our culture today.
Yeah.
To adapt that. There are many terms that we use that are, if they're understood correctly, are not real problems, but they do create, words we use are problematical.
And I agree that when using those terms, one has to be careful enough as to explaining them properly as to people get the right notion and not thinking like, we are promoting something inhuman or whatever. And there are so many historical, generational implications in words that generations tend to interpret them in one way, next generation another. And I may use one word and I have three generations in the audience and each of them understands the word differently. When I say slave, yes. The other one is like... So I have to speak to clarify to each three generation, what do I really mean by that particular word? And sometimes that's not easy, so we'll have to be careful. I generally do not use that word so cheaply. Only when I know I will have the time to clarify what does it mean. Because sometimes, the person may end going with the wrong idea and there was no chance to clarify that. But strictly speaking, divine slavery is the ultimate freedom, technically speaking. Although freedom and slavery may sound like contradictory, but divine slavery for us is to begin with, and why we don't like the word slavery, because the reference in this world is you are forced to that condition.
That's right.
Or when we speak about surrender, surrender to God. In this world, the word surrender is connected with you are on a battlefield, surrender.
Right.
So you don't have an option. You have to surrender. But when we speak surrender to God, it's a voluntary action. There's nobody pointing at me like this. Or you say slavery to God, it makes sense because I'm choosing voluntarily to do that. I'm offering my will to that. It's not like I'm being forced to be a slave. And so the word is the same, but the connotation is like they're worlds apart. So For us, it's very important, this idea of there's a part of our voluntary offering, because that's, how to say, that speaks about the our own responsibility in the process also, because that's an important part. Sometimes we may speak about God and His grace, and that's fine, but there is a part that we have to choose to embrace those things. He may be extremely merciful and loving, but I have to choose embracing that mercy. Do you follow? God may extend His costless grace to me. I do not deserve that, but it is still coming when I deserve it the less. So glorious, but nonetheless, I have to accept that.
Are you using Hindu? Are you words from your tradition or our tradition? Because it's the same.
The
right?
Two, yeah, both.
Okay.
In right. This case, we are. I think we are speaking about the same thing.
Okay.
Huh?
Right.
So we have this idea of costless mercy, costless grace. But it doesn't mean that there's no price to pay for that, for example. I mean, there's a high price to pay. I mean, for me, it's higher that price. Because we see costless mercy, we may think, I don't have to do anything, and that's coming. And I mean, that's coming without you not deserving that, but you have to do something to honor that gift. Mm-hmm. No? It's like if I want to give you a gift, and I ask you, the only thing you have to do is receive it, put the hand. It's something, you have to do that part. I cannot do that for yourself. And sometimes it may be hard for us even to do that, because sometimes it's so difficult to trust what's coming from above. Well, sometimes we are not so much accustomed to trust, which has a lot to do with faith. I mean, faith and confidence and trust goes hand by hand, but sometimes doubt and fear so much ingrained in our psyche. So gradually we need to work on those things.
I was thinking that as you were talking about the words like surrender and slavery too, if we don't trust each other.
Mm-hmm.
We need to trust each other to be able to use that language and understand.
Mm-hmm.
You know, without feeling like we have to judge that the way the language.
Yeah. In our tradition, that's a very important point to find like-minded partners in our practice. Because I understand that you cannot trust every single person on earth immediately, if you will. You cannot just open your heart to an stranger, if you will. At least we don't have that capacity in the beginning. But we have to begin surrounding ourselves with like-minded people that we feel they are trustworthy and they are their company and inspiration invites to. Gradually, we may open a little bit and test. Let's see if it works. Okay, yes, it's working. Because when you open yourself, you are becoming vulnerable. You are showing who you actually are with all your doubts, with all your fears, with all your fragility, vulnerability. So you can be abused in that situation or you can be nourished. No? So when you start to try that in some sustainable installments and it works, I show myself my vulnerable side, and I receive so much love and affection. Next time you open a little bit more. And of course you will be much more empowered. And in this way you open till you get to the point of surrender or slavery in this sense. You choose to do that. You choose to give yourself to someone voluntarily. That's love creates the highest type of bonding. Bond can be a bad word or it can be you can control someone by love. That's the highest form of control. I can try to control you physically and take you and put you in a cage by force. Or I can try to control you psychically, like even to the point that you do not realize I'm doing that. Or I can control you by love. But the point is that when I control you by love, you are controlling me also. That's reciprocal. If I control you by love means I love you, but it means probably the same thing is happening in the other. So the two sides are controlled. In our tradition, there are many verses like that, speaking about God as the one who is totally beyond control, but He's controlled by love. No. which is not a limitation. I know there are words, but when you are being loved and you are loving, and you feel this is my highest prospect, my highest potential is coming here. My real self in all its possibilities is there in love. But you can speak about that condition as a bond, as control, a slavery, which all sound like limiting, but your subjective experience is, no, here I am, all that I can be.
See, it makes me think of the word vulnerability came into my mind, and I'm thinking about, so if God is both being controlled by love, God is being vulnerable to be hurt, right? I mean, is that, God be hurt?
If God can be hurt?
Yeah, can God be hurt?
Well...
if we don't love him as he wants us, he's given his heart, he's given everything to us to love, and we don't, we fall short.
Mm-hmm. I wouldn't speak in terms of being hurt, at least in a mundane way, as maybe we may experience being hurt. Because sometimes we feel hurt from a selfish side, let's say. No, but God is not selfish, so his experience of being hurt cannot come from that. So try to understand that whatever God feels is totally beyond the realm of material conditioning, limitations, selfishness.
There's no feeling.
Sorry?
There's no feeling.
Yeah, there is feeling, but not from a limited perspective. Like my point is, for example, I can suffer. I'm selfish, let's say. And I want something to happen from a selfish perspective, and it's not happening, so I'm suffering. But I'm suffering because I'm selfish. It's a type of suffering. In another example, I'm not selfish, and I'm totally compassionate. And I see someone suffering, and I suffer. Mm-hmm. So I'm suffering also. But that's not, there's no selfishness. By that suffering, my heart is growing.
Does God suffer with you?
Again, sir?
Does God suffer with you?
So that's the type of suffering that can be ascribed to God. I mean, God does not have a personal experience of our tradition, of selfishness, because he's not under that influence. But he can understand that we may be suffering because of that. Do you follow? I mean, there's different forms of empathy, we may call. Sometimes they're called cognitive empathy and affective empathy. So cognitive empathy means, for example, I don't know, your mother passed away, and my mother did not pass away, so I don't know what that means fully, but I can understand why you are suffering. On some level, in a cognitive way, I can be empathic. But if I have gone through that same experience, it's called affective empathy. I can fully connect with your experience, and I can empathize even more. So in our tradition, we will say God doesn't know what does it mean to be selfish, but it's not a limitation on him. Because if you try to accommodate that, he also is selfish, then we have a big theological problem. How can God be selfish? I mean, but in his capacity, he can understand the suffering that comes out of the selfishness that may still be in us, let's say, and he can help us. He can help us, and he can also arrange through for us. In our tradition, we conceive he also will send saintly people to our lives who have gone through the experience of selfishness, and they know what that means, but now they are beyond that, and they can help us, ourselves, to go beyond that. So he's making this, he's covering all the bases from that side, basically, something like that.
But God is not having feelings.
What do you mean by feelings? Maybe that's a grammatical, semantic thing that we need
God isn't having feelings about our feelings or our inequities or whatever. It's not saying thinking. Judging, you're not being enough, you're not loving enough. Like God isn't feeling. He isn't getting enough from you. Mm-hmm. God isn't feeling that. I don't think there's the feeling, like we know feeling.
Mm-hmm.
The emotions, we don't. God doesn't have that.
I mean,
God is beyond that.
I mean, I'm sure in the perspective of our tradition, again, I'm not trying to impose anything, but I appreciate your thoughts.
Tradition.
No, I appreciate. I mean, in our tradition, we will say, of course, God is not ungrateful. So if we are trying to give something to him, let's say, he will generally take the least thing we are trying to give, and he will try to take that as an excuse to give himself to us, if you will. Even if we are still in work in progress, basically. He will take like the essence of the offering, of the intention, and try to magnify that, mm-hmm. no, out of his mercy. We don't think so much in terms of God saying, that's not enough, give me more.
Yeah.
You are not loving me enough. I demand that you give me, at least that's not our perspective. But at the same time, again, this may be a semantic issue, but regarding feelings or emotions, we consider that God has emotions and feelings. Again, not as we experience them as a limited being, but to say that God cannot feel is to impose for us a big limitation here. But whatever he feels is in the context of his liberated situation, liberated status, if you will, his enlightened situation. And there are feelings there. It's not that we only have emotions, because sometimes this idea may come, okay, we are on the in the conditioned side of creation, if you will, and here there are feelings. So we may conclude, so on the other side, there may be no feelings, because maybe the other side is the opposite here. So here we have forms, there are no forms. If here there are feelings, there are no feelings. Some people have concluded like that. Of course, we do not follow that idea. We consider whatever we find here is like a hint of what's happening there in a perfect way. So if here there are forms, there are also forms, but we consider them spiritual forms.
Because this is a question of mine, because I'm very much involved in the worship part of our service,
mm-hmm.
and the thing that I've thought about when we worship God, it's like a love. I think of it as a love letter,
mm-hmm.
and I'm offering God my love letter. Now, mm-hmm. I know He loves me, but He's not going to sing a hymn to me. He's going to do something else.
Mm-hmm.
He's going to bless me in His own way.
Mm-hmm.
When we give God that, let God be God.
Uh-huh.
But I often wonder, and I wonder if we can ever know that, other than when we offer a love letter to God, when we get that back, we get it back in something that's not describable.
Mm-hmm.
It's beyond description.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It's ineffable.
Mm-hmm.
And I think when you get to questions like what you're saying, unless you believe that thing that you can't describe that goes beyond the script, then those other kind of questions are like, well, maybe God doesn't love me the way I think of love or think of hurt, but I know He loves me like nobody else does. So I mean, that's almost enough. I'm not trying to make Him so much like me that that'll satisfy me.
Yeah, that's what I guess I'm kind of getting at.
Yes.
God doesn't have to be like me to love me.
Mm-hmm.
You have to know your love.
And this idea of surrender, at least for us, is very, very like foundational to the idea of love. Now, for us, before starting to speak about love, generally we speak about surrender, like a preliminary ground for loving God. Like and surrender, again, as we were speaking, in a positive way, but as a willingness to allow God to be who He is and to trust that however He will choose to address me, that will be the best possible way, and be very careful about not being like projecting prejudice on Him and conditioning, He should be like this, He should reply as such, because I mean, you are approaching the unlimited. So unlimited means there can be unlimited ways He will reply to your approach, and you should be willing to trust whatever form it takes. I have deep faith that this is the best possible gift. You know, there's a nice story in one of our books called Srimad Bhagavatam of one great devotee called Sudama. And he went to visit Krishna, and Sudama was very poor, but he was okay. But his wife was not that okay. So she told him, you are going to visit Krishna. And Krishna, at that moment, he had lots of riches and so on. She said, Krishna is your friend from childhood, so ask him some a little bit so we can get something. But he was feeling, I love Krishna so much, I don't want to go and visit my dear friend and ask him money. I mean, I'm not for that. So he went, was with Krishna, well, long story short, and Krishna knew his mind, and Krishna knew that he was on a mission, I mean, his wife was on a mission, but he didn't say anything. Sudam never asked money. So he, after that, he returned to his house, and he was totally satisfied of meeting his Lord and not asking anything from him. So he was feeling, oh, this is his mercy to me. But when he reached, on the way, he was thinking on way back. When he arrived to his home, he realized that his little cottage became like a palace. So actually Krishna gave all the things. And then he was in ecstasy again by seeing how Krishna was choosing to give his mercy in that particular form. So he was in ecstasy when Krishna chose not to give anything externally. He was so happy. And when he saw Krishna gave me everything externally, he was so happy. Because he thought, in both cases, he's giving me his mercy. So his mercy will take so many forms. And actually, technically speaking, I don't care which form it takes. The important thing is that the mercy is being given. And at one point I trust that the only thing that can come from him is mercy. The point is that I'm like attuned, aligned with that reality, basically, no? But well, yeah, very, very nice thoughts. So I don't know if I'm speaking too much. You let me know. Or if you are too hungry. I mean, you continue, no problem. Someone has taken the lead there, so no problem.
Just thinking of a few analogies, like along these lines that I heard that might may be helpful, that like when a child makes like a macaroni picture, you know, like gluing the macaroni to a paper or something, like some very rudimentary form of art, but then it's presented to the parent out of affection, the parent will see that as something really wonderful and will cherish it. So in the same way, you know, whatever endeavor we're making to connect with God, God does have that feeling of love, even if it's on a very different level from what we're able to render or offer. Out of affection, there's an exchange of feeling there. Mm-hmm. And then, oh yeah, we're just going way back in time now, but just this, that God is serving his servants, made me think very much of Jesus when he's washing the feet of the disciples.
Well, indeed, in this story that I've shared of Sudama, Krishna is washing the feet of Sudama, actually. So there's this, I didn't mention that, but it's also a similar situation. So many parallels you will find if you start to study. Yeah, there's one quote in our tradition, say, Baba Grahi Janardana, which means God takes the essence of what we are offering to him. No matter some imperfection in the externalities of it, he's taking the spirit of the offering. And there's a nice verse in the Gita which says that, Patram Pushpam Phalam Tuyam, and so on. I'm still torturing you with Sanskrit. I say I wouldn't, sorry. So Krishna's saying there, if someone offers me a leaf, a flower, some water, things like that, fruit, some simple stuff, but with love and devotion, I accept that. Like implying, I'm not asking big stuff, just a drop of water, not like the most insignificant thing, but please with love. In that verse, two times he uses the word bhakti, not only once, twice. He says one fruit, one water, one drop, one this, but two bhaktis. But two times love. No? And this famous story of Vidura's wife in that connection. No? When I'll briefly tell that. Krishna once invited to a big feast that was organized by someone called Duryodhan. But this Duryodhan actually was not the lover of Krishna. He wanted to obtain Krishna's favor more in a political way. You know, he wanted to have Krishna on his side. So he thought, I will organize a great feast. And I will receive him with royal, I don't know, band playing and all this show. So I have Krishna on my side. But again, Krishna is seen beyond all that. So to say that Krishna came, and on both sides of the road, big feast and band and all the Krishna receiving was there, and Krishna just walked through the main road like the three monkeys, you know, like not hearing, not like blind to that, because he perceived there's no real spirit in this offering. You know? And he went to the end of the street, where was the house of a very dear devotee of him called Vidura. So he knocked on the door, and looking for Vidura, he was not there at home. It was his wife there. So you can imagine, you are at home, someone knocks your door, you open the door, oh, it's God visiting you. Oh my gosh. Unexpected visitor. Indeed, in India, they say, Atithi Devo Bhava, which means you should treat an uninvited guest as God himself.
That's a Christian thing, too.
Yeah. Because, of course, the idea is not only being a good host, but also the idea is God will come to your life over and over again as uninvited guest. So better you are ready to be a good host. How much hosting capacity we have for the divine. So again, the point is Krishna knocked. So this great devotee, the wife of Vidura, was there, and Krishna said to her, I'm hungry. Directly. I mean, he was at home. No? So we are at home, you will say, maybe there is something in the kitchen that... You will say, I'm hungry. If you go to your mom, I'm hungry. And she will be happy to feed you. No? So Krishna was at home. They say, I'm hungry. But they were very poor. They didn't have anything almost. But they have some few bananas. So she said, I have only some bananas. Krishna said, bring the bananas. Again, he wanted the bag, the love, not the bananas. God is hungry of love. That's his diet based on bhakti. So it is said that the wife of Vidura came, and she was so much like in ecstasy, in ecstatic joy by having Krishna at home, that she started peeling the bananas, and instead of giving Krishna the bananas and throwing the peels, she started to give Krishna the peels and throwing the bananas. So not the most perfect offering, technically speaking. But to everyone's surprise, Krishna took the peels and started eating the peels. Because he could see the background of this so-called mistake is an overflow of love that makes her make that imperfection, which actually is the highest perfection. So Krishna, this verse of the Gita, say, I will accept fruit. He doesn't say, I will eat it. I will accept it. But in this story, he's not only accepting the peels, he's eating the peels. And asking for more. Of course, that doesn't mean that we will offer God banana peels. No? I mean, if you are in ecstasy and you are not aware of that, that's one thing. But if not, we are invited to offer the best we have to him. But that's a story that shows how much he's going beyond the formality of the offering and just taking the spirit of it. And that's, in one sense, our hope, but that's also a challenge, because that means we have to have our heart in the right place. We cannot make an external show of everything in place externally for God. But he will look, but where is your heart? Which place is your heart? I'm only interested in that. So that's the greatest challenge, actually. It sounds very simple. Oh, he's asking only fruit, water, leaf. But no, he's asking your heart, actually. No, for us, we may offer something to God, but the idea of that offering is that someday we conclude, I am the offering. Actually, all the things that I'm offering are just preparing the ground so I can offer myself fully. I am the ultimate offering. So at least that for us, what bhakti is about. Not so much doing something and offering it to Krishna, but offering ourselves to Krishna and then doing something. Or doing whatever we are doing, we are trying to do that on the basis of first trying to offering ourselves. And I'm not saying simple. I'm not saying, I never use the word easy in the whole lecture. but I never use the word impossible either. So that's important, because sometimes when we say something it's difficult. But difficult doesn't mean impossible. Actually, difficult is, as I like to say, the middle point. It's not an extreme. Extreme is easy and impossible. Those are the extremes. We are not interested in that pendulum. Easy, impossible. But middle point. What's the middle point? Difficult. Not that difficult that becomes impossible, but and not that less difficult that becomes easy, but in just enough challenging so we can keep growing always. Sustainable difficulty, if you will. Because we have to make our spiritual project sustainable also. No? If not, we go neurotic, or discouraged. So it is too much, too difficult, too high, and I'm too low. or if it's too easy, I get bored, and I take everything for granted. I know what this is about. I become proud. Who knows? So many possibilities. So just keep the difficult middle point in place. And for us, that's important to have the company of also other people, because sometimes we ourselves may not be capable of maintaining ourselves in that middle difficulty point, and we may tend to complacency or neurosis and over-demanding. So we need some well-wishers that may support our case from and will help us to remain in that middle point. And we go a little bit too much to one extreme or the other, let's get back on track. So thank you all of you for being that type of companions, because of course your presence and questions, we are all part of this, on this same journey, basically.
I actually have a question that sort of ties into what you just said, fortunately. You mentioned mysticism before, and I believe you used a word about that referenced someone who believes what they believe but isn't open to a higher truth. Was it Kanaka or something?
Kanishta. Kanaka is another term, interestingly, but that's another.
But you referenced mysticism as you know, someone who is open to a larger truth and more connected with other traditions. I'm not a religious scholar. My you know, view of different faiths. Sort of recognizing there's maybe a spectrum. On one end, there's fundamentalism and maybe orthodoxy, and then maybe the mainstream, and then mysticism, and many different. I've heard mysticism referred to in a number of different traditions. In your view, and I guess this could be open to anyone who's studied, or is mysticism maybe the point in which the various faiths converge?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, of course, when I mentioned that in connection to mysticism, that was one way of speaking about that. I mean, it's not the only thing I have to say about mysticism in our tradition. But yeah, I agree that if you are a real mystic, I mean, no matter which tradition you belong to, you will be able to perceive this like underlying spiritual unity in all these traditions, which doesn't mean that at the end, all of us will end up worshipping Krishna, or Jesus, or you follow. But you will be capable enough to understand all those forms of the divine, if you will, or faces of the absolute, all belong to this.
Same.
There's this unified feel or foundational ground that is absolute. Again, we are not thinking dual terms. We are transcending the dual mind, because mind is thinks in dual terms. Hot, heat, cold, like, I dislike that, it's happy, sad, and the world of duality is born out of the mind. So the word mystic actually means that. Now the word mystica means he who is beyond mind and senses, basically. To go beyond mind and senses. So from that platform, there's no duality. No. It's like if you are here and you see, oh, sun is covered by the cloud. For you here, if you are in the sun, it's never covered. You always see the light, if you will, from that side. So if you become a mystic, you go beyond the dualities of the mind and you see everything else from those lens. No, the unity is there. And on the basis of that unity, you can appreciate diversity without it being a conflict. But if you don't have that base of unity, when you try to deal with diversity, you may feel even threatened in your own faith. And for some people, it may be healthy not to expose themselves to too much diversity, because they need first to be a little bit sectarian in the beginning. It's part, no? Like a child will think, my dad is the best father of the world, and it's okay. And at the beginning, he will think, there's nobody else like my father for anyone. And it's okay, it's part of his maturation. But eventually he has to realize, okay, I keep feeling that for myself, but it's perfect that each of you feel the same for your particular father. So you find the diversity, but there is some unity. So yeah, a mystic has to exhibit those. And that's why you can, for me, the hope that every tradition will have their mystics. And they are the people who really maintain the tradition. Yeah, I generally think in this term, you have the mystic orientation and you have the religious orientation, if you will. Mm-hmm. Now, religious in the sense of a more social, mm-hmm. like belonging to a group and doing certain things, but not being so much concerned of having God as to, okay, he's helping me in my life here to have all my things in place. Thank you, God, so much. But mystic is someone who wants to go beyond all those things.
Can I say something about that? Because I'm going to, I'm wrestling with some of the tapes that you've given me. And what I've come to understand is, in my ignorance, it was always, if you were a Thomas Merton, if you were a contemplative, you were serious about God. And if you weren't that in depth and committed and driven to be close to God on that level, that you were not, that you were less than contemplative. Mm-hmm. And I think that when we start saying things like fundamentalists and clarifying putting people in categories, if you love God, I don't care whether you're a Merton or whether you're me, mm-hmm. I still love, and love is love in that relationship.
Mm-hmm.
I understand that God can call some people to a very serious place where mystics choose to go to.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a wonderful thing. But I also understand that you shouldn't go there unless you really feel called to be there.
Mm-hmm.
So just because there is a mystical experience, it doesn't mean that everyone is called to be a Thomas Merton.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It doesn't make you a better person or, mm-hmm. you know, in our culture, we like to think, oh, if you're not this, mm-hmm. then you're not.
Oh, yeah.
You haven't arrived yet. You know what I mean? I mean, I can read about contemplation and what's involved.
Mm-hmm.
And you can read about things like St. John of the Cross and
yeah.
all that mm-hmm. kind of stuff. And it's wonderful and it's blissful, but I'm not sure I'm ready for that.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, because that's quite an amazing thing.
Mm-hmm.
Scarlett tells me how she spends time, you know, every day with, you know, just in your prayer room, and I'm thinking, wow, I can't even do that. I can't every day. You know, I mean, how could I even think about being? And it reminds me of the time. Just one more thing. I'm sorry.
Yeah, no.
Richard Rohr was talking about, I thought this was funny, Richard Rohr was talking about visiting the place where he was at in Kentucky, his monastery.
New Mexico.
Yeah, 70, yeah.
Ah, and Marathon, okay.
And he was talking to the monks there, and he mentioned the word Thomas Merton.
Yeah, I know that. That everyone started to become like uncomfortable and serious.
They're uncomfortable.
And he asked one friend, why this happened?
Yes.
And this other, but you said you will say that.
No. He didn't understand why everybody was uncomfortable because Thomas Merton was used to be with them.
Yeah.
Who's the abbot there? And why they were uncomfortable. And he basically said to them, they were angry with Thomas because he said to them, you're not contemplatives, you're just introverts. And they took that very personally.
He was like straightforward, basically.
So, I mean, we're not all ready for
strong
that,
words,
you know.
Yeah,
that's all. Said.
Yeah, I agree. But also, I will say that, of course, there are different takes to spirituality and how to approach God. But also, I will say that there are certain things that we all have to go through. You know, like, for example, as I was mentioning, in a very general way, you know, like to get free from selfishness and to work on some things. It's not that, oh no, my path to God is I keep being selfish forever and nonetheless I will get there. Mm. No? So that's my point. There are some common universal things that we all have to go through, no matter you are a monastic or you are a lay person. I mean, that's, and again, yeah, I agree that it's not that you have to go to a monastery to become a swami. I recently gave a lecture on that because some people in our tradition even think you have to become a swami, and I said, no, you don't have to become a swami. And because I am swami, it's not that I'm higher than you. Mm-hmm. I mean, I just have a particular nature that takes me to monastic life, but it's not that you cannot love God if you are not a monastic. I mean, loving God means loving God. You can have a family and serve your family in the context of serving God. I mean, if you really love God, everything, you will make everything part of that equation. If you really are longing fervently to love God, I mean, you will put your house in service to God, you will put your dog in service to God, you will put everything that comes your path. It's not that I need to go to the cave in the mountain to whatever. No? That may be evasive in some cases.
Yes.
Mm. Some people may look for monastic life as a way of not dealing with certain realities, not taking full responsibility. Because, I mean, being a monk is not no joke.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if you really want to do it properly, you have to be... I mean, you have to be... I mean, you have to live with yourself all day long. There's not that many other people around. You have to all day long coexist with your mind, and that's... I mean, you can go crazy by doing that. So, everyone has to find their place, but the point is, find your place in the world from which you find this is the most, the best platform from which I can jump into transcendence, if you will. And that's perfect. And so, anyhow.
I don't know how long you're going to go. I don't want to keep asking questions.
Yeah, we already are. No, I mean, we have eternity in one sense.
Can we eat?
But also
no,
we no. That's part of the equation.
I'm
we have been speaking like for an hour and a half now.
Yeah.
So I don't know if you think if
can
you
I question or just a comment in my reading and listening and to mystics and in my faith tradition and getting the understanding that the desire to go on that path is what God has put in me. I haven't done anything. It just God puts that in me, the desire to learn and listen. But in your tradition, is that what is the desire God calling, or is something we have to do to get there? Like,
I will speak in both terms.
Okay.
No, because there's two people on two sides, no, if you will. No? There's God as a person, as an individual, trying to relate to us, but also it's us going through our own particular experience. So let's say we are going through some experiences and of suffering. I think many people get to spirituality by suffering. That's a big gateway. Not like you suffer, you try in the wrong, knocking on the wrong doors for many times, and you're like, oh my gosh, I mean, I don't want this anymore. I mean, is there any other... So you start to open yourself to other possibilities and you become more sensitive. So that's part of your own journey. And even though you are not doing that consciously, okay, I will suffer, so after that I'm open to spirituality. You are just, I mean, you are looking, maybe without knowing, for those things that you will only find in God, but you are looking in the wrong place. But you are looking for God unknowingly, let's say. So you are doing your part unconsciously, and by doing that in the wrong door, nonetheless, you end up suffering, and indirectly that's taking you closer to God. And of course, he has been trying to approach you from time immemorial, if you will, but in many situations we were not ready to, like, to hear the call. And sometimes we need to go through certain experiences where we really become more humble, let's say, for example, to realize I need, I don't know, help. I need so many things. We are so needy. So that's my point. It's not only one way street. No, of course God is trying, but also the point is we are speaking about love here. So love is not an imposition. No, if I force you, and you have no choice in the matter, how much of love is there? No, if I tell you, love me, and you tell me, is there any other options for me? I said, no, sorry. So how much of a loving choice is that one? If I have no other choice, and it's by force. So he's calling us. He's willing to give himself, but he's also waiting for us to use our will to voluntarily choose to embrace his call. That's what makes it have sense, because if not, it's not love. And of course, there's risk in that, because if I give you some other option apart from loving God, that means you may end up choosing doing nonsense, and that's, we see the world, we see the result of that. But if you cancel that, then you don't have will. You become an automaton or something, because their only choice is loving God. And if there's no other choice, that's no choice either. If I only have one choice, that's not a choice. If I have to choose, I have to have at least a second choice to have. So we have had that choice. We have chosen the wrong direction for quite a long time. And at some point we realize, okay, let me try this other one, if you will. And something in those lines we will conceive. No, there's part of God's free will, real free will, and our will that hopefully is becoming more and more free the more we choose in the right direction. Okay, so I think we can close here. And I think there is some conclusive prayer or something you told me.
Yeah.
Or no, that was not in the...
Should we do a closing prayer, just like we did an opening prayer?
Wait, that would be a good idea.
Yes.
Do you have a plan?
I mean, if there is no plan, no problem. It's okay. Just...
Yeah, we can come up with something or it's funny.
Some prayer?
Yeah.
But again, I don't have any paper or anything.
Do a prayer and then what... At a Christian service, what they do is just a benediction,
mm-hmm.
Just to go, may the grace of God, and love God the Father, the fellowship
mm-hmm.
of the Holy Spirit, be with
peace
you.
Peace be with you, yeah.
Yeah, all of that. So we kind of say that at the end of a service, and stuff,
mm-hmm.
so we could do something like that.
Mm-hmm.
You just did.
Oh, no.
I was thinking the same thing, yeah. Unofficially, but it's there. God took the essence of the offering.
Yes.
Yeah. So I may share one verse that comes to mind that also is very nice, but it's prayer by one great devotee in our tradition called Britrasura. He says, Aham harita bapadai kamola dasanu daso babitasmi bhuya manasmarita supater gunamste grinita vakkarma karo tukhayam. So basically he's saying... The only thing I pray for, and he's praying, but he's somehow inviting us to join him. I'm praying to eternally remain a permanent servant of the servant of your servants. He's not only saying, I want to be your servant, God, but the servant of your servants of your servant. And may my mind be always engaged in thinking about you. May my words be always engaged in glorifying you. And may my body be always engaged in serving you. So may all my faculties basically be absorbed in eternally serving you and those who are serving you and those who are serving those who are serving you and so on. So all of you are included in that equation. So that's our prayer. May we all become servants of each of you. So thank you so much for the invitation. Again, it has been a very wonderful, mystical experience, I will say. And I hope someday we may repeat it somehow or other.
Sure,
thank you so much.
Thank you.